Lawrence supposed no one could blame them for their appearance, as they had been brought over without baggage.
"Well, at least he is gone to some purpose, and we cannot but be relieved by this news that there is no alliance with France," he said to Temeraire.
"Yes,"
Temeraire said, but unenthusiastically. He had been quite silent all this time, brooding and coiled about the garden. The tip of his tail continued flicking back and forth restlessly at the edge of the nearer pond and spattering thick black spots onto the sun-heated flagstones, which dried almost as quickly as they appeared. Lawrence did not immediately press him for explanation. Even now Hammond had gone, but came and sat by his head. He hoped deeply that Temeraire would speak of his own volition and not require questioning.
"Are all the rest of my crew all right also?"
Temeraire asked after a moment.
Lawrence said, "Willoughby has been killed, I am very sorry to tell you. A few injuries besides, but nothing else mortal, thankfully."
Temeraire trembled and made a low keening sound deep in his throat.
"I ought to have come. If I had been there, they could never have done it."
Lawrence was silent, thinking of poor Willoughby, a damned ugly waste.
"You did very wrong not to send word," he said finally. "I cannot hold you culpable in Willoughby's death. He was killed early before you would ordinarily have come back, and I do not think I would have done anything differently had I known you were not returning. But certainly you have violated your leave."
Temeraire made another small, unhappy noise, and said, low,
"I have failed in my duty, have I not? So it was my fault, then, and there is nothing else to be said about it."
Lawrence said, "No, if you had sent word, I would have thought nothing of agreeing to your extended absence. We had every reason to think our position perfectly secure. And in all justice, you have never been formally instructed in the rules of leave in the corps, as they have never been necessary for a dragon, and it was my responsibility to be sure you understood. I am not trying to comfort you," he added, seeing that Temeraire shook his head, "but I wish you to feel what you have in fact done wrong, and not to distract yourself improperly with false guilt over what you could not have controlled."
"Lawrence, you do not understand," Temeraire said. "I have always understood the rules quite well. That is not why I did not send word. I did not mean to stay so long. Only I did not notice the time passing."
Lawrence did not know what to say. The idea that Temeraire had not noticed the passage of a full night and day, when he had always been used to come back before dark, was difficult to swallow, if not impossible. If such an excuse had been given him by one of his men, Lawrence would have outright called it a lie. As it was, his silence betrayed what he thought of it. Temeraire hunched his shoulders and scratched a little at the ground, his claws scraping the stones with a noise that made Chuan look up and put his ruff back with a quick rumble of complaint. Temeraire stopped. Then all at once he said abruptly,
"I was with May."
"With who?"
Lawrence said blankly.
"Lung Chin May," Temeraire said. "She is an imperial."
The shock of understanding was near a physical blow. There was a mixture of embarrassment, guilt, and confused pride in Temeraire's confession, which made everything plain.
"I see,"
Lawrence said with an effort, as controlled as ever he had been in his life.
"Well,"
he stopped and mastered himself,
"you are young and have never courted before. You cannot have known how it would take you," he said. "I am glad to know the reason. That is some excuse."
He tried to believe his own words. He did believe them, only he did not particularly want to forgive Temeraire's absence on such grounds. Despite his quarrel with Hammond over Yong Xing's attempts to supplant him with the boy, Lawrence had never really feared losing Temeraire's affections. It was bitter, indeed, to find himself so unexpectedly with real cause for jealousy after all. They buried Willoughby in the grey hours of the morning in a vast cemetery outside the city walls, to which Sun Kai brought them. It was crowded for a burial place, even considering the extent, with many small groups of people paying respects at the tombs. These visitors' interest was caught by both Temeraire's presence and the Western party, and shortly something of a procession had formed behind them, despite the guards who pushed off any too curious onlookers. But though the crowd shortly numbered several hundreds of people, they maintained an attitude of respect, and fell to perfect silence while Lawrence somberly spoke a few words for the dead, and led his men in the Lord's Prayer. The tomb was above ground, and built of white stone with an upturned roof very like the local houses. It looked elaborate even in comparison with the neighbouring mausoleums.
"Lawrence, if it wouldn't be disrespectful, I think his mother would be glad of a sketch,"
Granby said quietly.
"Yes, I ought to have thought of it myself,"
Lawrence said.
"Digby, do you think you could knock something together?"
"Please allow me to have an artist prepare one,"
Sun Kai interjected.
"I am not ashamed not to have offered before, and assure his mother that all the proper sacrifices will be made. A young man of good family has already been selected by Prince Mianning to carry out all the rites."
Lawrence assented to these arrangements without investigating further. Mrs. Willoughby was, as he recalled, a rather strict Methodist, and he was sure would be happier not to know more than that her son's tomb was so elegant and would be well maintained. Afterwards, Lawrence returned to the island with Temeraire and a few of the men to collect their possessions, which had been left behind in the hurry and confusion. All the bodies had been cleared away already, but the smoke-blackened patches remained upon the outer walls of the pavilion where they had sheltered, and dried bloodstains upon the stones. Temeraire looked at them a long time, silently, and then turned his head away. Inside the residence, furniture had been wildly overturned, the rice-paper screens torn through and most of their chests smashed open, clothing flung onto the floor and trampled upon. Lawrence walked through the rooms as Blythe and Martin began collecting whatever they could find in good enough condition to bother with. His own chamber had been thoroughly pillaged, the bed itself flung up on its side against the wall, as if they had thought him maybe cowering underneath, and his many bundles from the shopping expedition thrown rudely about the room. Powder and bits of shattered porcelain trickled out across the floor behind some of them like a trail, strips of torn and frayed silk hanging almost decoratively about the room. Lawrence bent down and lifted up the large, shapeless package of the red vase, fallen over in a corner of the room, and slowly took off the wrappings. And then he found himself looking upon it through an unaccountable blurring of his vision, the shining surface wholly undamaged, not even chipped, and in the afternoon sun it poured out over his hands a living richness of deep and scarlet light. The true heart of the summer had struck the city now. The stones grew hot as worked anvils during the day, and the wind blew an endless stream of fine yellow dust from the enormous deserts of the Gobi to the west. Hammond was engaged in a slow, elaborate dance of negotiations, which, so far as Lawrence could see, proceeded only in circles. A sequence of wax-sealed letters coming back and forth from the house, some small trinkety gifts received and sent in return, vague promises and less action. In the meantime they were all growing short-tempered and impatient, except for Temeraire, who was occupied still with his education and his courting. May now came to the residence to teach him daily, elegant in an elaborate collar of silver and pearls. Her hide was a deep shade of blue, with dapplings of violet and yellow upon her wings, and she wore many golden rings upon her talons.
"May is a very charming dragon," Lawrence said to Temeraire after her first visit, feeling he might as well be properly martyred. It had not escaped his attention that May was very lovely, at least as far as he was a judge of draconic beauty.
"I am glad you think so also," Temeraire said, brightening. The points of his ruff raised and quivered. "She was hatched only 3 years ago, and has just passed the first examinations with honour. She has been teaching me how to read and write, and has been very kind. She has not at all made fun of me for not knowing."
She could not have complained of her pupil's progress, Lawrence was sure. Already Temeraire had mastered the technique of writing in the sand tray tables with his talons, and May praised his calligraphy done in clay. Soon she promised to begin teaching him the more rigid strokes used for carving in soft wood. Lawrence watched him scribbling industriously late into the afternoon, while the light lasted, and often played audience for him in May's absence. The rich, sonorous tones of Temeraire's voice, pleasant though the words of the Chinese poetry were meaningless, except when he stopped in a particularly nice passage to translate. The rest of them had little to occupy their time. Mianning occasionally gave them a dinner, and once an entertainment consisting of a highly unmusical concert and the tumbling of some remarkable acrobats, nearly all young children and limber as mountain goats. Occasionally they drilled with their small arms in the courtyard behind the residence, but it was not very pleasant in the heat, and they were glad to return to the cool walks and gardens of the palace after. Some 2 weeks following their remove to the palace, Lawrence sat reading in the balcony overlooking the courtyard where Temeraire slept, while Hammond worked on papers at the writing desk within the room. A servant came bearing them a letter. Hammond broke the seal and scanned the lines, telling Lawrence,
"It is from Liu Bao. He has invited us to dine at his home."
"Hammond, do you suppose there is any chance he might be involved?"
Lawrence asked reluctantly, after a moment.
"I do not like to suggest such a thing, but after all, we know he is not in Mian Ning's service, like Sun Kai is. Could he be in league with Yongxing?"
"It is true we cannot rule out his possible involvement," Hammond said. "As a Tartar himself, Liu Bao would likely have been able to organize the attack upon us. Still, I have learned he is a relation of the Emperor's mother, and an official in the Manchu White Banner. His support would be invaluable, and I find it hard to believe he would openly invite us if he meant anything underhanded."
They went warily, but their plans for caution were thoroughly undermined as they arrived, met unexpectedly at the gates by the rich, savoury smell of roasted beef. Liu Bao had ordered his now well-travelled cooks to prepare a traditional British dinner for them, and if there was rather more curry than one would expect in the fried potatoes, and the currant-studded pudding inclined to be somewhat liquid, none of them found anything to complain of in the enormous crown roast, the upstanding ribs jewelled with whole onions, and the Yorkshire pudding was improbably successful. Despite their very best efforts, the last plates were again carried away almost full, and there was some doubt whether a number of the guests would not have to be carted off in the same manner, including Temeraire. He had been served with plain, freshly butchered prey in the British manner, but the cooks could not restrain themselves entirely, and had served him not merely a cow or sheep, but two of each, as well as a pig, a goat, a chicken, and a lobster. Having done his duty by each course, he now crawled out into the garden uninvited with a little moan, and collapsed into a stupor.
"That is all right. Let him sleep," Liu Bao said, waving away Lawrence's apology. "We can sit in the moon-viewing terrace and drink wine."
Lawrence girded himself, but for once Liu Bao did not press the wine on them too enthusiastically. It was quite pleasant to sit, suffused with a steady, genial warmth of inebriation, the sun going down behind the smoke-blue mountains, and Temeraire drowsing in an aureate glow before them. Lawrence had entirely, if irrationally, given up the idea of Liu Bao's involvement. It was impossible to be suspicious of a man while sitting in his garden, full of his generous dinner. And even Hammond was half unwillingly at his ease, blinking with the effort of keeping awake. Liu Bao expressed some curiosity as to how they had come to take up residence with Prince Mian Ning. For further proofs of his innocence, he received the news of the gang attack with real surprise, and shook his head sympathetically.
"Something has to be done about these Hun Hun. They are really getting out of hand. One of my nephews got involved with them a few years ago, and his poor mother worried herself almost to death. But then she made a big sacrifice to Guanyin, and built her a special altar in the nicest place in their south garden, and now he has married and taken up studying."
He poked Lawrence in the side.
"You ought to try studying yourself. It will be embarrassing for you if your dragon passes the examinations, and you don't."
"Good God, could that possibly make a difference in their minds, Hammond?"
Lawrence asked, sitting up, appalled. For all his efforts, Chinese remained to him as impenetrable as if it were enciphered 10 times over, and as for sitting examinations next to men who had been studying for them since the age of 7...
But, "I am only teasing you,"
Liu Bao said good-humouredly, much to Lawrence's relief.
"Don't be afraid. I suppose if Lung Tian Xiang really wants to stay companion to an unlettered barbarian, no one can argue with him."
"He is joking about calling you that, of course,"
Hammond added to the translation, but a little doubtfully.
"I am an unlettered barbarian by their standards of learning, and not stupid enough to make pretensions to be anything else,"
Lawrence said.
"I only wish that the negotiators took your view of it, sir," he added to Liu Bao. "But they are quite fixed that a celestial may only be companion to the Emperor and his kin."
"Well, if the dragon will not have anyone else, they will have to live with it,"
Liu Bao said, unconcerned.
Why doesn't the Emperor adopt you? That would save face for everyone.
Lawrence was disposed to think this a joke, but Hammond stared at Liu Bao with quite a different expression.
Sir, would such a suggestion be seriously entertained?
Liu Bao shrugged and filled their cups again with wine.
Why not? The Emperor has 3 sons to perform the rites for him. He doesn't need to adopt anyone, but another doesn't hurt.
Do you mean to pursue the notion? Lawrence asked Hammond, rather incredulous, as they made their staggering way out to the sedan chairs waiting to bear them back to the palace.
With your permission, certainly, Hammond said. It is an extraordinary idea, to be sure, but after all it would be understood on all sides as only a formality. Indeed, he continued, growing more enthusiastic, I think it would answer in every possible respect. Surely they would not lightly declare war upon a nation related by such intimate ties, and only consider the advantages to our trade of such a connection.
Lawrence could more easily consider his father's likely reaction.
If you think it a worthwhile course to pursue, I will not forestall you, he said reluctantly.
But he did not think the red vase, which he had been hoping to use as something of a peace offering, would be in any way adequate to mend matters if Lord Allendale should learn that Lawrence had given himself up for adoption like a foundling, even to the Emperor of China.
Chapter 16
It was a close-run affair before we arrived, that much I can tell you, Riley said, accepting a cup of tea across the breakfast table with more eagerness than he had taken the bowl of rice porridge. I have never seen the like, a fleet of 20 ships with 2 dragons for support. Of course, they were only junks and not half the size of a frigate, but the Chinese Navy ships were hardly any bigger. I cannot imagine what they were about to let a lot of pirates get so out of hand.
I was impressed by their admiral, however. He seemed a rational sort of man, Staunton put in. A lesser man would not have liked being rescued.
He would have been a great gaby to prefer being sunk, Riley said, less generous.
The 2 of them had arrived only that morning, with a small party from the Allegiance. Having been shocked by the story of the murderous gang attack, they were now describing the adventure of their own passage through the China Sea. A week out of Macau, they had encountered a Chinese fleet attempting to subdue an enormous band of pirates who had established themselves in the Joshan Islands to prey upon both domestic shipping and the smaller ships of the Western trade.
There was not much trouble once we were there, of course, Riley went on. The pirate dragons had no armaments. The crews tried to fire arrows at us, if you can credit it, and no sense of range at all. Dived so low we could hardly miss them at musket shot, much less with the pepper guns. They sheered off pretty quick after a taste of that, and we sank 3 of the pirates with a single broadside.
"Did the Admiral say anything about how he would report the incident?"
Hammond asked Staunton.
"I can only tell you that he was punctilious in expressing his gratitude. He came aboard our ship, which was, I believe, a concession on his part."
"And let him have a good look at our guns," Riley said. "I fancy he was more interested in those than in being polite. But at any rate, we saw him to port, and then came on. She's anchored in Tien-Sing Harbour now. No chance of our leaving soon?"
I do not like to tempt fate, but I hardly think so, Hammond said. The Emperor is still away on his summer hunting trip up to the north, and he will not return to the summer palace for several weeks more. At that time I expect we will be given a formal audience.
I have been putting forward this notion of adoption, which I described to you, sir, he added to Staunton. We have already received some small amount of support, not only from Prince Mianning, and I have high hopes that the service which you have just performed for them will sway opinion decisively in our favour.
"'Is there any difficulty in the ship's remaining where she is?'
Lawrence asked, with concern.
"'For the moment, no, but I must say, supplies are dearer than I had looked for,' Riley said. "'They have nothing like salt meat for sale, and the prices they ask for cattle are outrageous. We've been feeding the men on fish and chickens.'
"'Have we outrun our funds?'
Lawrence, too late, began to regret his purchases.
"'I have been a little extravagant, but I do have some gold left.' And they make no bones about taking it once they see it is real.
"'Thank you, Lawrence, but I don't need to rob you. We are not in Dun territory yet,' Riley said. "'I am mostly thinking about the journey home. With a dragon to feed, I hope?'
Lawrence did not know how to answer the question. He made some evasion and fell silent to let Hammond carry on the conversation. After their breakfast, Sun Kai came by to inform them that a feast and an entertainment would be held that evening to welcome the new arrivals, a great theatrical performance.
"'Lawrence,
"I am going to go and see Qian," Temeraire said, poking his head into the room while Lawrence contemplated his clothing. "You will not go out, will you?" He had grown singularly more protective since the assault, refusing to leave Lawrence unattended. The servants had all suffered his narrow and suspicious inspection for weeks, and he had put forward several thoughtful suggestions for Lawrence's protection, such as devising a schedule which should arrange for Lawrence's being kept under a 5-man guard at all hours, or drawing in his sand table a proposed suit of armour which would not have been unsuited to the battlefields of the Crusades.
"No, you may rest easy. I'm afraid I will have enough to do to make myself presentable," Lawrence said. "Pray give her my regards. Will you be there long? We cannot be late tonight. This engagement is in our honour."
"No, I will come back very soon," Temeraire said, and true to his word returned less than an hour later, rough, quivering with suppressed excitement, and clutching a long, narrow bundle carefully in his forehand. Lawrence came out into the courtyard at his request, and Temeraire nudged the package over to him rather abashedly. Lawrence was so taken aback he only stared at first. Then he slowly removed the silk wrappings and opened the lacquered box. An elaborate, smooth-hilted sabre lay next to its scabbard on a yellow silk cushion. He lifted it from its bed, well balanced, broad at the base, with the curved tip sharpened along both edges, the surface watered like good Damascus steel, with 2 blood grooves cut along the back edge to lighten the blade. The hilt was wrapped in black ray skin, the fittings of gilded iron adorned with gold beads and small pearls, and a gold dragon-head collar at the base of the blade with 2 small sapphires for eyes. The scabbard itself of black lacquered wood was also decorated with broad gold bands of gilded iron and strung with strong silk cords. Lawrence took his rather shabby, if serviceable, cutlass off his belt and buckled the new one on.
"Does it suit you?" Temeraire asked anxiously.
"Very well indeed," Lawrence said, drawing out the blade for practice, the length admirably fitted to his height. "My dear, this is beyond anything. However did you get it?"
"Well, it is not all my doing," Temeraire said. "Last week Qian admired my breastplate, and I told her you had given it to me. Then I thought I would like to give you a present also. She said it was usual for the sire and dame to give a gift when a dragon takes a companion, so I might choose one for you from her things, and I thought this was the nicest."
He turned his head to one side and another, inspecting Lawrence with deep satisfaction.
"You must be quite right. I could not imagine a better," Lawrence said, attempting to master himself.
He felt quite absurdly happy and absurdly reassured, and on going back inside to complete his dress could not help but stand and admire the sword in the mirror. Hammond and Staunton had both adopted the Chinese scholar robes. The rest of his officers wore their bottle-green coats, trousers, and hessians polished to a gleam. Neckcloths had been washed and pressed, and even Roland and Dyer were perfectly smart, having been set on chairs and admonished not to move the moment they were bathed and dressed. Riley was similarly elegant in navy blue, knee-breeches and slippers, and the 4 marines whom he had brought from the ship in their lobster-red coats brought up the end of their company in style as they left the residence. A curious stage had been erected in the middle of the plaza where the performance was to be held, small but marvellously painted and gilded, with 3 different levels. Qian presided at the centre of the northern end of the court, Prince Mianning and Chuan on her left, and a place for Temeraire and the British party reserved upon her right. Besides the celestials, there were also several Imperials present, including May, seated farther down the side and looking very graceful in a rig of gold set with polished jade. She nodded to Lawrence and Temeraire from her place as they took their seats. The white dragon Lien was there also, seated with Yong Xing to one side, a little apart from the rest of the guests. Her albino coloration again startling by contrast with the dark-hued Imperials and Celestials on every side, and her proudly raised ruff today adorned with a netting of fine gold mesh, with a great pendant ruby lying upon her forehead.
"Oh, there is Mian Kai!" Roland said in undertones to Dyer, and waved quickly across the square to a boy sitting by Mianning's side.
The boy wore robes similar to the Crown Prince's, of the same dark shade of yellow, and an elaborate hat. He sat very stiff and proper. Seeing Roland's wave, he lifted his hand part way to respond,
then dropped it again hastily, glanced down the table towards Yong Shing, as if to see if he had been noticed in the gesture, and sat back relieved when he realized he had not drawn the older man's attention.
"How on earth do you know Prince Mian Kai? Has he ever come by the Crown Prince's residence?"
Hammond asked. Lawrence also would have liked to know, as on his orders the runners had not been allowed out of their quarters alone at all, and ought not to have had any opportunity of getting to know anyone else, even another child. Roland, looking up at him, said, surprised,
"Why, you presented him to us on the island."
And Lawrence looked hard again. It might have been the boy who had visited them before in Yong Xing's company, but it was almost impossible to tell. Swathed in the formal clothing, the boy looked entirely different.
"Prince Mian Kai," Hammond said. "The boy Yong Xing brought was Prince Mian Kai."
He might have said something more. Certainly his lips moved. But nothing at all could be heard over the sudden roll of drums. The instruments evidently hidden somewhere within the stage, but the sound quite unmuffled and about the volume of a moderate broadside, perhaps 24 guns at close range. The performance was baffling, of course, being entirely transacted in Chinese, but the movement of the scenery and the participants was clever. Figures rose and dropped between the three different levels, flowers bloomed, clouds floated by, the sun and moon rose and set, all amid elaborate dances and mock swordplay. Lawrence was fascinated by the spectacle, though the noise was scarcely to be imagined, and after some time his head began to ache sadly. He wondered if even the Chinese could understand the words being spoken, what with the din of drums and jangling instruments and the occasional explosion of firecrackers. He could not apply to Hammond or Staunton for explanation. Through the entire proceeding, the two of them were attempting to carry on a conversation in pantomime, and paying no attention whatsoever to the stage. Hammond had brought an opera glass, which they used only to peer across the courtyard at Yong Xing, and the gouts of smoke and flame which formed part of the first act's extraordinary finale only drew their exclamations of annoyance at disrupting the view. There was a brief gap in the proceedings while the stage was reset for the second act, and the two of them seized the few moments to converse.
"Lawrence," Hammond said, "I must beg your pardon. You were perfectly right. Plainly Yong Xing did mean to make the boy Temeraire's companion in your place, and now at last I understand why. He must mean to put the boy on the throne somehow, and establish himself as regent."
"Is the Emperor ill, or an old man?" Lawrence said, puzzled.
"No," Staunton said meaningfully, "not in the least."
Lawrence stared.
"Gentlemen, you sound as though you are accusing him of regicide and fratricide both. You cannot be serious."
"I only wish I were not," Staunton said. "If he does make such an attempt, we might end in the middle of a civil war, with nothing more likely for us than disaster, regardless of the outcome."
"It will not come to that now," Hammond said confidently. "Prince Mian Ning is no fool, and I expect the Emperor is not either. Yong Xing brought the boy to us incognito for no good reason, and they will not fail to see that. Nor that it is of a piece with the rest of his actions, once I lay them all before Prince Mian Ning. First his attempts to bribe you, with terms that I now wonder if he had the authority to offer, and then his servant attacking you on board the ship. And recall, the Hun Hun gang came at us directly after you refused to allow him to throw Temeraire and the boy into each other's company. All of it forms a very neat and damning picture."
He spoke almost exultantly, not very cautious, and started when Temeraire, who had overheard all, said with dawning anger,
"Are you saying that we have evidence now, then? That Yong Xing has been behind all of this? That he is the one who tried to hurt Lawrence and had Willoughby killed?"
His great head rose and swiveled at once towards Yong Xing, his slit pupils narrowing to thin black lines.
"Not here, Temeraire," Lawrence said hurriedly, laying a hand on his side. "Pray do nothing for the moment."
"No, no," Hammond said also, alarmed. "I am not yet certain, of course. It is only hypothetical, and we cannot take any action against him ourselves. We must leave it in their hands."
The actors moved to take their places upon the stage, putting an end to the immediate conversation. Yet beneath his hand, Lawrence could feel the angry resonance deep within Temeraire's breast, a slow, rolling growl that found no voice but lingered just short of sound.
his talons gripped at the edges of the flagstones, his spiked ruff at half-mast, and his nostrils red and flaring. He paid no more mind to the spectacle, all his attention given over to watching Yong Xing. Lawrence stroked his side again, trying to distract him. The square was crowded full of guests and scenery, and he did not like to imagine the results if Temeraire were to leap to some sort of action, for all he would gladly have liked to indulge his own anger and indignation towards the man. Worse, Lawrence could not think how Yong Xing was to be dealt with. The man was still the Emperor's brother, and the plot which Hammond and Staunton imagined too outrageous to be easily believed. A crash of cymbals and deep-voiced bells came from behind the stage, and two elaborate rice-paper dragons descended, crackling sparks flying from their nostrils. Beneath them nearly the entire company of actors came running out around the base of the stage, swords and paste-jeweled knives waving, to enact a great battle. The drums again rolled out their thunder, the noise so vast it was almost like the shock of a blow driving air out of his lungs. Lawrence gasped for breath, then slowly put a groping hand up to his shoulder and found a short dagger's hilt jutting from below his collarbone. "Lawrence!" Hammond said, reaching for him, and Granby was shouting at the men and thrusting aside the chairs. He and Blythe put themselves in front of Lawrence. Temeraire was turning his head to look down at him.
"I am not hurt," Lawrence said confusedly.
There was queerly no pain at first, and he tried to stand up to lift his arm, and then felt the wound. Blood was spreading in a warm stain around the base of the knife. Temeraire gave a shrill, terrible cry, cutting through all the noise and music. Every dragon reared back on its hind quarters to stare, and the drums stopped abruptly. In the sudden silence, Roland was crying out,
"He threw it! Over there! I saw him!"
and pointing at one of the actors. The man was empty-handed, in the midst of all the others still carrying their counterfeit weapons, and dressed in plainer clothing. He saw that his attempt to hide among them had failed and turned to flee too late. The troop ran screaming in all directions as Temeraire flung himself almost clumsily into the square. The man shrieked once as Temeraire's claws caught and dragged mortally deep furrows through his body. Temeraire threw the bloody corpse, savaged and broken, to the ground. For a moment he hung over it, low and brooding, to be sure the man was dead, and then raised his head and turned on Yong Xing. He bared his teeth and hissed, a murderous sound, and stalked towards him. At once Lien sprang forward, placing herself protectively in front of Yong Xing. She struck down Temeraire's reaching talons with a swipe of her own foreleg, and growled. In answer, Temeraire's chest swelled out, and his ruff queerly stretched. Something Lawrence had never seen before. The narrow horns which made it up expanding outwards, the webbing drawn along with it. Lien did not flinch at all, but snarled almost contemptuously at him, her own parchment-pale ruff unfolding wide. The blood vessels in her eyes swelled horribly, and she stepped farther into the square to face him. At once there was a general hasty movement to flee the courtyard. Drums and bells and twanging strings made a terrific noise as the rest of the actors decamped from the stage, dragging their instruments and costumes with them. The audience members picked up the skirts of their robes and hurried away with a little more dignity, but no less speed.
"Temeraire, no!"
Lawrence called, understanding too late. Every legend of dragons dueling in the wild invariably ended in the destruction of one or both, and the white dragon was clearly the elder and larger.
"John, get this damn thing out!"
he said to Granby, struggling to unwind his neckcloth with his good hand.
"Blythe, Martin, hold his shoulders!"
Granby directed them, then laid hold of the knife and pulled it loose, grating against bone. The blood spurted for a single dizzy moment, and then they clapped a pad made of their neckcloths over the wound and tied it firmly down. Temeraire and Lien were still facing each other, fainting back and forth in small movements, barely more than a twitch of the head in either direction. They did not have much room to manoeuvre, the stage occupying so much of the courtyard, and the rows of empty seats still lining the edges. Their eyes never left each other.
"There's no use," Granby said quietly,
gripping Lawrence by the arm, helping him to his feet.
"Once they've set themselves on to duel like that, you can only get killed trying to get between them or distract him from the battle." "Yes, very well,"
Lawrence said harshly, putting off their hands. His legs had steadied, though his stomach was knotted and uncertain. The pain was not worse than he could manage.
"Get well clear," he ordered, turning around to the crew. "Granby, take a party back to the residence and bring back our arms in case that fellow should try to set any of the guards on him."
Granby dashed away with Martin and Riggs, while the other men climbed hastily over the seats and got back from the fighting. The square was now nearly deserted, except for a few curiosity-seekers with more bravery than sense, and those most intimately concerned. Qian observing with a look at once anxious and disapproving, and Mei some distance behind her, having retreated in the general rush and then crept partway back. Prince Mianning also remained, though withdrawn a prudent distance. Even so, Chuan was fidgeting and plainly concerned. Mianning laid a quieting hand on Chuan's side and spoke to his guards. They snatched up young Prince Miankai and carried him off to safety, despite his loud protests. Yongxing watched the boy taken away, and nodded to Mianning coolly in approval, himself disdaining to move from his place. The white dragon abruptly hissed and struck out. Lawrence flinched, but Temeraire had reared back in the bare nick of time, the red-tipped talons passing scant inches from his throat. Now up on his powerful back legs he crouched and sprang, claws outstretched, and Lien was forced to retreat, hopping back awkwardly and off balance. She spread her wings part way to catch her footing, and sprang aloft when Temeraire pressed her again. He followed her up at once. Lawrence snatched Hammond's opera glass away unceremoniously and tried to follow their path. The white dragon was the larger and her wingspan greater. She quickly outstripped Temeraire and looped about gracefully, her deadly intentions plain. She meant to plummet down on him from above. But the first flush of battle fury passed. Temeraire had recognized her advantage and put his experience to use. Instead of pursuing her, he angled away and flew out of the radiance of the lanterns, melting into the darkness.
"Oh, well done," Lawrence said.
Lien was hovering uncertainly mid-air, head darting this way and that, peering into the night with her queer red eyes. Abruptly, Temeraire came flashing straight down towards her, roaring, but she flung herself aside with unbelievable quickness. Unlike most dragons attacked from above, she did not hesitate more than a moment, and as she rolled away she managed to score Temeraire flying past. Three bloody gashes opened red against his black hide. Drops of thick blood splashed onto the courtyard, shining black in the lantern light. Mei crept closer with a small whimpering cry. Qian turned on her, hissing, but Mei only ducked down submissively and offered no target, coiling anxiously against a stand of trees to watch more closely. Lien was making good use of her greater speed, darting back and away from Temeraire, encouraging him to spend his strength in useless attempts to hit her. But Temeraire grew wily. The speed of his slashes was just a little less than he could manage, a fraction slow. At least so Lawrence hoped, rather than the wound giving him so much pain. Lien was successfully tempted closer. Temeraire suddenly flashed out with both foreclaws at once, and caught her in belly and breast. She shrieked out in pain and beat away frantically. Yongxing's chair fell over clattering as the prince surged to his feet, all pretense of calm gone. Now he stood watching with fists clenched by his sides. The wounds did not look very deep, but the white dragon seemed quite stunned by them, keening in pain and hovering to lick the gashes. Certainly none of the palace dragons had any scars. It occurred to Lawrence that very likely they had never been in real battle. Temeraire hung in the air a moment, talons flexing, but when she did not turn back to close with him again, he seized the opening and dived straight down towards Yongxing, his real target. Lien's head snapped up. She shrieked again and threw herself after him, beating with all her might, injury forgotten. She caught even with him just shy of the ground and flung herself upon him, wings and bodies tangling, and wrenched him aside from his course. They struck the ground rolling together, a single, hissing, savage, many-limbed beast clawing at itself, neither dragon paying any attention now to scratches or gouges, neither able to draw in the deep breaths that could let them use the divine wind against one another. Their thrashing tails struck everywhere, knocking over potted trees and scalping a mature stand of bamboo with a single stroke. Lawrence seized Hammond's arm and dragged him ahead of the crashing hollow trunks as they collapsed down upon the chairs with an echoing drum-like clatter. Shaking leaves from his hair and the collar of his coat, Lawrence awkwardly raised himself on his one good arm from beneath the branches. In their frenzy, Temeraire and Lien had just knocked askew a column of the stage. The entire grandiose structure began to lean over, sliding by degrees towards the ground, almost stately. Its progress towards destruction was quite plain to see, but Mian Ning did not take shelter. The prince had stepped over to offer Lawrence a hand to rise, and perhaps had not understood his very real danger. His dragon, Chuan, too, was distracted, trying to keep himself between Mian Ning and the duel. Thrusting himself up with an effort from the ground, Lawrence managed to knock Mian Ning down even as the whole gilt and painted structure smashed into the courtyard stones, bursting into foot-long shards of wood. He bent low over the prince to shield them both, covering the back of his neck with his good arm. Splinters jabbed him painfully even through the padded broadcloth of his heavy coat, one sticking him badly in the thigh where he had only his trousers, and another, razor-sharp, sliced his scalp above the temple as it flew. Then the deadly hail was past, and Lawrence straightened, wiping blood from the side of his face, to see Yong Xing, with a deeply astonished expression, fall over, a great jagged splinter protruding from his eye. Temeraire and Lien managed to disentangle themselves and sprang apart into facing crouches, still growling, their tails waving angrily. Temeraire glanced back over his shoulder towards Yong Xing first, meaning to make another try, and halted in surprise. One foreleg poised in the air. Lien snarled and leapt at him, but he dodged instead of meeting her attack, and then she saw. For a moment she was perfectly still, only the tendrils of her ruff lifting a little in the breeze, and the thin runnels of red-black blood trickling down her legs. She walked very slowly over to Yong Xing's body, and bent her head low, nudging him just a little, as if to confirm for herself what she must already have known. There was no movement, not even a last, nerveless twitching of the body, as Lawrence had sometimes seen in the suddenly killed. Yong Xing lay stretched out his full height. The surprise had faded with the final slackening of the muscles, and his face was now composed and unsmiling, his hands lying one outflung and slightly open, the other fallen across his breast, and his jewelled robes still glittering in the sputtering torchlight. No one else came near. The handful of servants and guards who had not abandoned the clearing huddled back at the edges, staring, and the other dragons all kept silent. Lien did not scream out, as Lawrence had dreaded, or even make any sound at all. She did not turn again on Temeraire either, but very carefully, with her talons, brushed away the smaller splinters that had fallen onto Yong Xing's robes, the broken pieces of wood, a few shredded leaves of bamboo. Then she gathered the body up in both her foreclaws, and carrying it, flew silently away into the dark.
Chapter 17. Lawrence twitched away from the restless, pinching hands, first in one direction, then the other. But there was no escape, either from them or from the dragging weight of the yellow robes, stiff with gold and green thread, and pulled down by the gemstone eyes of the dragons embroidered all over them. His shoulder ached abominably under the burden, even a week after the injury, and they would keep trying to move his arm to adjust the sleeves.
"Are you not ready yet?"
Hammond said anxiously, putting his head into the room. He admonished the tailors in rapid-fire Chinese, and Lawrence closed his mouth on an exclamation as one managed to poke him with a too hasty needle.
"Surely we are not late. Are we not expected at 2 o'clock?"
Lawrence asked, making the mistake of turning around to see a clock and being shouted at from three directions for his pains.
"One is expected to be many hours early for any meeting with the Emperor, and in this case we must be more punctilious than less,"
Hammond said, sweeping his own blue robes out of the way as he pulled over a stool.
"You are quite sure you remember the phrases and their order?"
Lawrence submitted to being drilled once more. It was at least good for distraction from his uncomfortable position. At last he was let go, one of the tailors following them halfway down the hall, making a last adjustment to the shoulders while Hammond tried to hurry him. Young Prince Miang Kai's innocent testimony had quite damned Yong Xing. The boy had been promised his own celestial, and had been asked how he would like to be emperor himself, though with no great details on how this was to be accomplished.
Yongxing's whole party of supporters, men who, like him, believed all contact with the West ought to be severed, had been cast quite into disgrace, leaving Prince Mianning once more ascendant in the court, and as a result, further opposition to Hammond's proposal of adoption had collapsed. The Emperor had sent his edict approving the arrangements, and as this was to the Chinese the equivalent of commanding them done instantly, their progress now became as rapid as it had been creeping heretofore. Scarcely had the terms been settled than servants were swarming through their quarters in Mianning's palace, sweeping away all their possessions into boxes and bundles. The Emperor had taken up residence now at his summer palace in the Yuanmingyuan garden, half a day's journey from Peking by dragon, and thence they had been conveyed almost pell-mell. The vast granite courtyards of the Forbidden City had turned anvils under the punishing summer sun, which was muted in the Yuanmingyuan by the lush greenery and the expanses of carefully tended lakes. Lawrence had found it little wonder the Emperor preferred this more comfortable estate. Only Staunton had been granted permission to accompany Lawrence and Hammond into the actual ceremony of adoption, but Riley and Granby led the other men as an escort, their numbers fleshed out substantially by guards and mandarins loaned by Prince Mianning to give Lawrence what they considered a respectable number. As a party they left the elaborate complex where they had been housed and began the journey to the audience hall where the Emperor would meet them. After an hour's walk, crossing some 6 streams and ponds, their guides pausing at regular intervals to point out to them particularly elegant features of the landscaped grounds, Lawrence began to fear they had indeed not left in good time. But at last they came to the hall, and were led to the walled court to await the Emperor's pleasure. The wait itself was interminable, slowly soaking the robes through with sweat as they sat in the hot, breathless courtyard. Cups of ices were brought to them, also many dishes of hot food, which Lawrence had to force himself to sample. Bowls of milk, and tea, and presents, a large pearl on a golden chain, quite perfect, and some scrolls of Chinese literature, and for Temeraire a set of gold and silver talon sheaths, such as his mother occasionally wore. Temeraire was alone among them, unfazed by the heat. Delighted, he put the talon sheaths on at once, and entertained himself by flashing them in the sunlight, while the rest of the party lay in an increasing stupor. At last the mandarins came out again, and with deep bows led Lawrence within, followed by Hammond and Staunton and Temeraire behind them. The audience chamber itself was open to the air, hung with graceful light draperies, the fragrance of peaches rising from a heaped bowl of golden fruit. There were no chairs, but the dragon couch at the back of the room, where a great male celestial presently sprawled, and the simple but beautifully polished rosewood chair which held the Emperor. He was a stocky, broad-jawed man, unlike the thin-faced and rather sallow Mianning, and with a small moustache squared off at the corners of his mouth, not yet touched with grey, though he was nearing 50. His clothes were very magnificent, in the brilliant yellow hue which they had seen nowhere else but on the private guard outside the palace, and he wore them entirely unconsciously. Lawrence thought not even the king had looked so casually in state robes on those few occasions when he had attended at court. The Emperor was frowning, but thoughtful rather than displeased, and nodded expectantly as they came in. Mianning stood among many other dignitaries to either side of the throne, and inclined his head very slightly. Lawrence took a deep breath and lowered himself carefully to both knees, listening to the mandarin hissing off the count to time each full genuflection. The floor was of polished wood, covered with gorgeously woven rugs, and the act itself was not uncomfortable. He could just glimpse Hammond and Staunton following along behind him as he bowed each time to the floor. Still, it went against the grain, and Lawrence was glad to rise at last with the formality met. Thankfully, the Emperor made no unwelcome gesture of condescension, but only ceased to frown. There was a general air of release from tension in the room. The Emperor now rose from his chair and led Lawrence to the small altar on the eastern side of the hall. Lawrence lit the stands of incense upon the altar, and parroted the phrases which Hammond had so laboriously taught him, relieved to see Hammond's small nod. He had made no mistakes then, or at least none unforgivable. He had to genuflect once more, but this time before the altar, which Lawrence was ashamed to acknowledge even to himself, was easier by far to bear,
though closer to real blasphemy. Hurriedly, under his breath, he said a Lord's Prayer, and hoped that should make quite clear that he did not really mean to be breaking the commandment. Then the worst of the business was over. Now Temeraire was called forward for the ceremony which would formally bind them as companions, and Lawrence could make the required oaths with a light heart. The Emperor had seated himself again to oversee the proceedings. Now he nodded approvingly, and made a brief gesture to one of his attendants. At once a table was brought into the room, though without any chairs, and more of the cool ices served while the Emperor made inquiries to Lawrence about his family, through Hammond's mediation. The Emperor was taken aback to learn that Lawrence was himself unmarried and without children, and Lawrence was forced to submit to being lectured on the subject at great length, quite seriously, and to agree that he had been neglecting his family duties. He did not mind very much. He was too happy not to have misspoken, and for the ordeal to be so nearly over. Hammond himself was nearly pale with relief as they left, and had actually to stop and sit down upon a bench on their way to their quarters. A couple of servants brought him some water, and fanned him until the colour came back into his face, and he could stagger on.
"I congratulate you, sir,"
Staunton said, shaking Hammond's hand as they at last left him to lie down in his chamber.
"I'm not ashamed to say I would not have believed it possible."
"Thank you, thank you,"
Hammond could only repeat, deeply affected. He was nearly toppling over. Hammond had won for them not only Lawrence's formal entree into the imperial family, but the grant of an estate in the Tartar city itself. It was not quite an official embassy, but as a practical matter it was much the same, as Hammond could now reside there indefinitely at Lawrence's invitation. Even the kowtow had been dealt with to everyone's satisfaction. From the British point of view, Lawrence had made the gesture not as a representative of the crown, but as an adopted son, while the Chinese were content to have their proper forms met.
"We have already had several very friendly messages from the mandarins at Canton through the Imperial Post. Did Hammond tell you?"
Staunton said to Lawrence, as they stood together outside their own rooms.
"The Emperor's gesture to remit all duties on British ships for the year will, of course, be a tremendous benefit to the company. But in the long run this new mindset amongst them will by far prove the more valuable. I suppose—"
Staunton hesitated. His hand was already on the screen frame, ready to go inside.
"I suppose you could not find it consistent with your duty to stay? I need scarcely say that it would be of tremendous value to have you here, though of course I know how great our need for dragons is back home."
Retiring at last, Lawrence gladly exchanged his clothes for plain cotton robes, and went outside to join Temeraire in the fragrant shade of a bank of orange trees. Temeraire had a scroll laid out in his frame, but was gazing out across the nearby pond rather than reading. In view, a graceful nine-arched bridge crossed the pond, mirrored in black shadows against the water, now dyed yellow-orange with the reflections of the late sunlight, the lotus flowers closing up for the night. He turned his head and nudged Lawrence in greeting.
"I have been watching. There is Lien," he said, pointing with his nose across the water.
The white dragon was crossing over the bridge, all alone except for a tall, dark-haired man in blue scholar robes walking by her side, who looked somehow unusual. After a moment squinting, Lawrence realized the man did not have a shaved forehead nor a queue. Midway, Lien paused and turned to look at them. Lawrence put a hand on Temeraire's neck instinctively, in the face of that unblinking red gaze. Temeraire snorted, and his ruff came up a little way, but she did not stay. Her neck proudly straight and haughty, she turned away again and continued past, vanishing shortly among the trees.
"I wonder what she will do now," Temeraire said.
Lawrence wondered also. Certainly she would not find another willing companion when she had been held unlucky even before her late misfortunes. He had even heard several courtiers make remarks to the effect that she was responsible for Yongxing's fate. Deeply cruel, if she had heard them, and still less forgiving opinion held that she ought to be banished entirely.
"Perhaps she will go into some secluded breeding grounds."
"I do not think they have particular grounds set aside for breeding here," Temeraire said. "May and I did not have to—"
Here he stopped, and if it were possible for a dragon to blush, he certainly would have undertaken it.
"But perhaps I'm wrong,"
he said hastily. Lawrence swallowed.
"You have a great deal of affection for May."
"Oh, yes," Temeraire said wistfully. Lawrence was silent. He picked up one of the hard little yellow fruits that had fallen unripe and rolled it in his hands.
"The Allegiance will sail with the next favourable tide, if the wind permits," he said finally, very low. "Would you prefer us to stay?"
Seeing that he had surprised Temeraire, he added,
"Hammond and Staunton tell me we could do a great deal of good for Britain's interests here. If you wish to remain, I will write to Lenton and let him know we had better be stationed here."
"Oh," Temeraire said, and bent his head over the reading frame. It was not paying attention to the scroll, but only thinking.
"You would rather go home, though, would you not?"
"I would be lying if I said otherwise," Lawrence said heavily. "But I would rather see you happy, and I cannot think how I could make you so in England, now you have seen how dragons are treated here."
The disloyalty nearly choked him. He could go no further.
"The dragons here are not all smarter than British dragons," Temeraire said. "There is no reason Maximus or Lily could not learn to read and write, or carry on some other kind of profession. It is not right that we are kept penned up like animals, and never taught anything but how to fight."
"No," Lawrence said. "No, it is not."
There was no possible answer to make, all his defence of British custom undone by the examples which he had seen before him in every corner of China. If some dragons went hungry, that was hardly a counter. He himself would gladly have starved sooner than give up his own liberty, and he would not insult Temeraire by mentioning it even as a sop. They were silent together for a long space of time, while the servants came around to light the lamps. The quarter moon, rising, hung mirrored in the pond, luminous silver, and Lawrence idly threw pebbles into the water to break the reflection into gilt ripples. It was hard to imagine what he would do in China, himself, other than serve as a figurehead. He would have to learn the language somehow after all, at least spoken, if not the script.
"No, Lawrence, it will not do. I cannot stay here and enjoy myself, while back home they are still at war and need me," Temeraire said finally. "And more than that, the dragons in England do not even know that there is any other way of doing things. I will miss May and Chian, but I could not be happy while I knew Maximus and Lily were still being treated so badly. It seems to me my duty to go back and arrange things better there."
Lawrence did not know what to say. He had often chided Temeraire for revolutionary thoughts, a tendency to sedition, but only jokingly. It had never occurred to him Temeraire would ever make any such attempt deliberately, outright. Lawrence had no idea what the official reaction would be, but he was certain it would not be taken calmly.
"Temeraire, you cannot possibly—" he said, and stopped,
the great blue eyes expectantly upon him.
"My dear," he said quietly after a moment, "you put me to shame. Certainly we ought not be content to leave things as they are. Now we know there is a better way."
"I thought you would agree," Temeraire said in satisfaction. "Besides," he added more prosaically, "my mother tells me that celestials are not supposed to fight at all, and only studying all the time does not sound very exciting. We had much better go home."
He nodded, and looked back at his poetry.
"Lawrence," he said, "the ship's carpenter could make some more of these reading frames, could he not?"
"My dear, if it will make you happy, he shall make you a dozen," Lawrence said,
and leaned against him, full of gratitude despite his concerns, to calculate by the moon when the tide should turn again for England and for home.
Selected extracts from A Brief Discourse upon the Oriental Breeds, with Reflections upon the Art of Draconic Husbandry, presented before the Royal Society, June 1801, by Sir Edward Howe, F.R.S.
The vast untrammelled serpentine hordes of the Orient are become a byword in the West, feared and admired at once, thanks in no small part to the well-known accounts of pilgrims from an earlier and more credulous era, which, while of inestimable value at the time of their publication, in shedding light upon the perfect darkness which preceded them,
to the modern scholar can hardly be of any use, suffering as they do from the regrettable exaggeration which was in earlier days the mode, either from sincere belief on the part of the author, or the less innocent, yet understandable desire to satisfy a broader audience, anticipatory of monsters and delights incalculable in any tales of the Orient. A sadly inconsistent collection of reports has thus come forward to the present day, some no better than pure fiction, and nearly all others distortions of the truth, which the reader would do better to discount wholesale than to trust in any particular. I will mention one illustrative example, the Sui Ryu of Japan, familiar to the student of draconic law from the 1613 account of Captain John Saris, whose letters confidently described as fact its ability to summon up a thunderstorm out of a clear blue sky. This remarkable claim, which should thus arrogate the powers of Jove to a mortal creature, I will discredit from my own knowledge. I have seen one of the Sui Ryu, and observed its very real capacity to swallow massive quantities of water and expel them in violent gusts, a gift which renders it inexpressibly valuable not only in battle, but in the protection of the wooden buildings of Japan from the dangers of fire. An unwary traveller caught in such a torrent might well imagine the skies to have opened up over his head with a thunderclap, but these deluges proceed quite unaccompanied by lightning or rain cloud, are of some few moments' duration, and, needless to say, not supernatural in the least. Such errors I will endeavour to avoid in my own turn, rather trusting to the plain facts, presented without excessive ornamentation, to suffice for my more knowledgeable audience. We can, without hesitation, dismiss as ridiculous the estimate, commonly put forth, that in China one may find a dragon for every 10 men, a count which, if it were remotely near the truth and our understanding of the human population not entirely mistaken, should certainly result in that great nation's being so wholly overrun by the beasts that the hapless traveller bringing us this intelligence should have had great difficulty in finding even a place to stand. The vivid picture drawn for us by Brother Matteo Ricci of the temple gardens, full of serpentine bodies, one overlapping the other, which has so long dominated the Western imagination, is not a wholly false one. However, one must understand that among the Chinese, dragons live rather within the cities than without, their presence thus all the more palpable, and they furthermore move hither and yon with far greater freedom, so that the dragon seen in the market square in the afternoon will often be the same individual observed earlier in morning ablutions at the temple, and then again, some hours later, dining at the cattle yards upon the city border. For the size of the population as a whole, we have, I am sorry to say, no sources upon which I am prepared to rely. However, the letters of the late Father Michel Benoit, a Jesuit astronomer who served in the court of the Qianlong Emperor, report that, upon the occasion of the Emperor's birthday, two companies of their aerial corps were engaged to overfly the summer palace in performance of acrobatics, which he himself, in company with two other Jesuit clerks, then personally witnessed. These companies, consisting of some dozen dragons apiece, are roughly equivalent to the largest of Western formations, and each assigned to one company of 300 men. 25 such companies form each of the 8 banner divisions of the aerial armies of the Tartars, which would yield 2,400 dragons acting in concert with 60,000 men. Already a more than respectable number, yet the number of companies has grown substantially since the founding of the dynasty, and the army is at present a good deal closer to twice the size. We may thus reliably conclude that there are some 5,000 dragons in military service in China, a number at once plausible and extraordinary, which gives some small notion of the overall population. The very grave difficulties inherent in the management of even so many as 100 dragons together in any singular and protracted military operation are well known in the West, and greatly constrain for practical purposes the size of our own aerial corps. One cannot move herds of cattle so quickly as dragons, nor can dragons carry their food with them live. How the supply of so vast a number of dragons may be orchestrated plainly poses a problem of no small order. Indeed, for this purpose, the Chinese have established an entire Ministry of Draconic Affairs. It may be that the ancient Chinese practice of keeping their coins strung upon cords is due to the former necessity of providing a means of handling money to dragons. However, this is a relic of earlier times, and since at least the Tang dynasty, the present system has been in place. The dragon is furnished, upon reaching maturity, with an individual hereditary mark, showing sire and dame, as well as the dragon's own rank. This having been placed on record with the ministry, all funds due to the dragon are then paid into the general treasury, and dispersed again on reception of markers which the dragon gives to those merchants, primarily herdsmen, whom it chooses to patronize. This would seem, upon the face of it, a system wholly unworkable. One may well imagine the results were a government to so administer the wages of its citizenry. However, it most curiously appears that it does not occur to the dragons to forge a false mark when making their purchases. They receive such a suggestion with surprise and profound disdain, even if hungry and short of funds. Perhaps one may consider this as evidence of a sort of innate honour existing among dragons, or in any event family pride, yet at the same time they will without hesitation, or any consciousness of shame, seize any opportunity which offers of taking a beast from an unattended herd or stall, and never consider leaving payment behind. This is not viewed by them as any form of theft, and indeed in such a case the guilty dragon may be found devouring his ill-gotten prey, while sitting directly beside the pen from which it was seized, and ignoring with perfect ease the complaints of the unhappy herdsman who has returned too late to save his flock. Themselves scrupulous in the use of their own marks, the dragons are also rarely made victims of any unscrupulous person who might think to rob them by submitting falsified markers to the ministry. Being as a rule violently jealous of their wealth, dragons will at once on arriving in any settled place go to inquire as to the state of their accounts and scrutinize all expenses, and so quickly notice any unwarranted charge upon their funds or missing payment. And by all reports, the well-known reactions of dragons to being robbed has no less force when that theft occurs in this manner indirectly and out of their view. Chinese law expressly waives any penalty for a dragon who kills a man proven guilty of such a theft. The ordinary sentence is indeed the exposure of the perpetrator to the dragon. Such a sentence of sure and violent death may seem to us a barbaric punishment, and yet I have been assured several times over by both master and dragon that this is the only means of consoling a dragon so abused and restoring it to calm. This same necessity of placating the dragons has also ensured the steady continuance of the system over the course of better than 1,000 years. Any conquering dynasty made it nearly their first concern to stabilize the flow of funds, as one can well imagine the effects of a riot of angry dragons. The soil of China is not naturally more arable than that of Europe. The vast necessary herds are rather supported through an ancient and neatly contrived scheme of husbandry, whereby the herdsmen, having driven some portion of their flocks into the towns and cities to sate the hungry dragons, returning carry away with them great loads of the richly fermented night soil collected in the dragon middens of the town, to exchange with the farmers in their rural home districts. This practice of using dragon night soil as fertilizer, in addition to the manure of cattle, almost unknown here in the West due to the relative scarcity of dragons and the remoteness of their habitations, seems especially efficacious in renewing the fertility of the soil. Why this should be so is a question as yet unanswered by modern science, and yet well evidenced by the productivity of the Chinese husbandmen, whose farms, I am reliably informed, regularly produce a yield nearly an order of magnitude greater than our own.
This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Throne of Jade by Naomi Novik, published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2006 by Naomi Novik. Production copyright 2007, Books on Tape.